This is Seeds for Success, a show where we have a good yarn about ag life with producers who are having a go. On the show, you'll hear from farmers in New South Wales who are out there battling the elements, making tough calls and getting the job done. You'll get a laugh out of some of their stories and also pick up some know-how along the way. I'm your host, Neralee Brennan. Today, we're continuing our chat with Greg Wynn. In our last episode, Greg shared with us his experience working in corporate agriculture and the importance of getting the numbers right. In this episode, we delve into the other side of Greg's agricultural pursuits, managing his own mixed farming business on Stratford, a 1,000-hectare soldier settler block just south of Condobolin. Due to unforeseen family circumstances, Greg, along with his wife, have been able to start their own farming business on his wife's family property. As you'll hear Greg explain to us, Stratford had been leased for many years, and with the flooding on the Lachlan last year, they've used the opportunity to approach the business with a blank slate. Greg has used flood lines and mapping to assign their land use to soil type and capability, in order to mitigate against future drought and floods. And being a smaller scale farmer, Greg also has some interesting strategies to reduce machinery overheads and to try and attract farming contractors. Local Land Services mixed farming advisor, Rowan Leach, sat down with Winnie at home on Stratford to bring you this chat.
So, Winnie, thanks for your time on the corporate side and your experience with AAM. We might go into your own personal situation here. So what's the name of your property?
So this is Stratford. So this is my wife's family farm. So an old soldier settlement block, as we alluded to earlier. And we've been provided an opportunity, I guess, for lack of a better word, to be able to manage this farm for Margot's family. Unfortunately, due to some unforeseen family tragedy, which is a very bittersweet circumstance that we found ourselves in, but we are going to make the most of it for lots of reasons. So, yeah, it's Stratford's an old soldier settlement block, which traditionally in this part of the world were 2,500 acres, so nearly 1,000 hectares. And we're on the Wallamundry Creek system. So we're actually on the Wallaroy Creek, but that's an irrigation scheme essentially. So a lot of the blocks here were split up with 1,000 hectares and a little bit of irrigation water. And this farm's one of the last ones in this little location that's probably stayed within the family now in entirety, a lot of them being busted up or sold on or whatever, as is very common in most Australian ag. So, yeah, it's home for Margot and her family and her mum. So that's really important to us. That'll guide us in our future too. Like, we'll probably think about this farm a little bit differently than if we went out and bought a farm, because it's home. So it'll be treated a little bit differently for that, and we certainly don't want to. We're about generational thinking here. We want it for our kids and grandkids, and we also don't want to leave it in a worse spot than when we took it on. So,
what's sort of the business structure that you've come into with this now?
So we have started our own little business, I guess, which is the management side of the farm, and then the farm ownership is sitting with Margot's family. So my wife and I started a little business, which is the management side of things, and she is the general manager and director of all things finance. So she holds the purse strings and I'm the labourer.
You're the crap kicker.
Yeah. What we want to do is essentially what, you know, we've been doing for AAM and the corporate side of things is we believe in that philosophy, like most farmers in this district, in this greater region, I guess, is in that. As a risk mitigant, you know, a mixed farming operation, in our opinion, probably provides us with a lower risk profile. So we want to run a combination of cropping and livestock.
And in the previous episode, you mentioned that you've sat down and done a reconciliation on and an assessment to match up land use to soil type and that sort of thing. So what have you done? What have you chosen here?
This farm compromises of three of its boundaries is a creek. So it's got a lot of water frontage, and as the nature of a creek, it meanders and has lots of creek bends and lots of big red gum trees. So also typically what happens on floodplains is the highest elevation, the landscape is often close to the creek. So where the water's moving the fastest deposits the heaviest material, and then further you get away from the creek, it's typically your floodplain where it deposits the lighter material. What that means operationally is along the creek is often sandier, loamier, and higher in elevation. And then the further you get away from the creek is typically darker soil, higher clay content, and lower in elevation. So when you look at a flood map of this farm, which we can do now with satellite imagery from the last flood, which is a cracker, biggest that has ever been recorded in this part of the world by, you know, up to 30 centimetres higher than ever recorded. So it was a big flood. So for us starting on our journey, I guess we've seen the biggest flood that anyone's seen in this part of the world in living memory. So we can use that then to go, well, these are the parts of the farm that becomes inundated with water. These are the parts that were high and dry. That, as I alluded to before, really follows that along the creeks is higher with a loamier, sandier soil. And then further away from the creek is your heavy flood inundation. So from a livestock point of view, we don't really want them running around in a flood. We'd rather them on the higher country where it's drier. So it works really well, in my opinion, is we've got creek bends with lots of shelter, large red gum trees running around the boundary, provides lots of windbreaks and shelter. And you get really nice protected little creek bends. But it also grows more feed because you're getting shade in the afternoons and you're getting less evaporation from wind due to the high trees. So what that does on a map for us, that just drew a really nice line down the nearly down the middle of the farm and said, righto, well, these are the areas that we are going to focus our livestock on, and we're going to embark on a pasture, like a pasturing, so planting improved pasture on a lot of that country. And then the flood country is where we're going to focus our cropping on. Now, a couple of reasons we do that is, you know, some of the cost-benefit analysis we determined in our last episode, when you're putting a pasture in, there's a lot of upfront cost. You know, seed's expensive, sowing's expensive. So to get the best cost-benefit analysis over that, we amortize it over several years. What that means is we can say if it costs $100 a hectare for the seed, instead of just putting that all in your first year, you can put that over the years that the pasture is going to be alive. So we don't really want to spend that money in somewhere that's going to be flooded and we lose it in the first year. So that's what works really good on this farm, is that we can invest significant money into a pasture scheme where we're not going to lose it in a flood. That is also really beneficial that the sheep are walking around on drier ground where the pasture is growing and they're not walking around in heavy clay mud in water. So,
and by extension, if it's flooding, it's obviously raining really a heap. So that pasture is going to be high and dry and growing like steam.
That's really, you know, what was at the forefront of our mind when we sat down and sort of planned out what we were going to do for the next few years. Be interesting to see how we would have thought if we'd just come off the biggest drought ever. We might have thought that maybe we would have gone down a different track, but I think we're going down the right track for this farm. So, yeah, that's our plan. As is, we've decided to go down the DORPA track. AAM invested in a DORPA stud locally, and after working with those animals and processes, I really believe there's a good future for shedding breeds, particularly DORPAs, in this part of the world and further west. Not, I wouldn't say jury's out, but I still think the second cross lamb's got a really strong future further east in the higher performance. But I think, you know, as we get out this way, our rainfall is less, and yeah, it's really taken the place of that merino market, I think, for us. You know, there is issues with labour and stuff with the merinos, as I think most producers are probably finding. And I worked on a merino place and ran lots of merinos, so it's been a big shift, and I was probably like everybody, that bloody goats and all that sort of stuff. But we've made the decision to get in this track, and we're hopeful that the benefits will outweigh some of the perceived issues with shedding breeds, the fencing and whatnot. But all that being said, they are harder to keep in than a merino. So that's something that we've said, right, we're going to go down this DORPA track, but we need to invest in fencing to do that, because you don't want to upset your neighbours by having DORPAs run around with their merinos. So that's, we said, righto, well, this is the line. So we need to invest in pasture and fencing in this part of the world. And then on the other part where we're going to crop, we're sort of going to try and make that as efficient as we can. So in the livestock part of our business or area of our business, we're going to increase the number of paddocks. There's those smaller paddock sizes with more fences, more paddocks so we can rotationally graze. And especially with these animals in that they are fairly indeterminate grazers. So they'll eat just about everything. And this part of the world can grow weeds, as we all know, pretty well. So instead of spending a huge amount of money on controlling weeds, we're hoping that they can become part of a food source in the short term until we get the pasture established. And once the pasture established, as you would know, Rowan, like, it is competitive against weeds. Weeds are a function of no competition, essentially. So we're going to invest in intensifying the livestock thing. So more paddocks, higher stocking rates, less grazing days, so more recovery. And then in the cropping side of the business, we're actually going to pull out fences and make it more efficient and certainly invest in nutrition. So inherently, the material that was deposited here over many thousands of floods is lower than phosphorus. So unless you add that to the system, then you're not going to reach your maximum amount of grain yield off a given amount of rainfall.
Going back to the topic of pasture establishment, out here in a bit of a western environment, a bit more marginal, as you've said, yeah, what sort of pastures are you putting in?
It'll predominantly be a Lucerne Phalaris mix. So deep-rooted perennials is where I believe we're going to get our best bang for buck in terms of persistence and being able to utilise, you know, groundwater or deep soil moisture. But some of these creek bends, so you see the physical creek that runs around, there is also water that runs underground in and around creeks. So what we see is the deep-rooted perennial plants are able to access some of that water close to the creek. So I hope that we can establish, you know, deep-rooted perennial plants that can tap into some of that groundwater and sod water. And then, as we alluded to before, in these environments, if you don't have ground cover and competition, then, you know, weeds can become an issue. So those perennials are very competitive. So, yeah, that's the hope, that we can manage the amount of reliance we have on having to control weeds all the time. It's time-consuming and expensive.
So a lot of people down the Lachlan have certainly been wiped out with these floods, and their pastures have been flooded. What, in your experience, has been some of the species that persist the best after a flood over them?
Yeah, so Phalaris for us at work, like at AAM, we very similar country. We have floodplain country and want to do something very similar and invest in pastures. And Lucerne, I love Lucerne, like performance-wise, being able to turn fat lambs off Lucerne is just, I don't think there's too much that gives it a run, to be honest. But it is prone to waterlogging. So it is suited to, you know, sandier soils that are well-drained, which isn't conducive of a lot of our country, unfortunately. So we typically have poorly drained, heavy textured soils. So we've found in those situations Phalaris has been terrific. And the variation we have in paddocks, you know, we're able to do a Phalaris-Lucerne mix, and then the Lucerne tends to establish better on the higher sandier stuff, and then the waterlogged stuff down the bottom of the profile will, you know, the Phalaris establishes and grows really well. And we've had three of the wettest years, consecutive years, and, you know, a lot of the Phalaris has been able to not only survive but thrive in those situations. So we've had we've had excess feed from the Phalaris where we've actually had to, you know, introduce cattle into the system because it was just too much biomass for the sheep to control, and very impressed with the Phalaris. And then, you know, the mix will probably also throw some annuals in there in the event that, you know, we have a favourable season and they can get going in the winter periods.
And what annuals are you sort of selecting for this environment?
Oh, medics and subclovers, yeah, pretty basic.
Have you thought of any of those Bicerula, Ceradella, those hard-seeded varieties? Balanza,
yeah,
maybe?
I have used them certainly on more acid soils. We've had really good results there. We just can't get clovers to persist or medics to persist. Typically, we're slightly on the alkaline, neutral alkaline here. So I think we'll get better bang for out of our clovers and... But, yeah, I've seen them grow in Patry acid and grow really well. Like, they're a freak of a plant in their environment, yeah.
I think you're probably going down the right track with the medics in this. You can just see the naturalised medic that grows the trefoil. It goes like stink. So if we can put it in a bit of a more high-performance variety, then, yeah, you're looking down the right track. Mate, just going into your cropping now. So what are your plans with your cropping?
So on paper, my favourite rotation would be an oilseed, a cereal, a pulse, a serial in a four-year rotation. I believe in that situation you're providing rotation of chemistry for weeds. I believe you're providing a nitrogen-fixing crop in there as well, reducing your reliance on bag fertilizer. You're avoiding diseases by not having cereal on cereal. That's always been my on-paper philosophy. Now, we all know there's so many reasons why we can't always achieve that, but that'll be my overarching philosophy, whether we're able to pull that off every year. One of the risks that we will take into consideration is, because we're not a very big farm, do you do the whole area to canola, for example? So canola in this part of the world is perceived as quite a risky crop. So we would increase our risk profile by going all canola, in my opinion. So, but if we have it, then we haven't got a lot of area, which doesn't make us very attractive to find a windrow or a spray coop, for example. So that's just some of the considerations that we'll take into account moving forward. But yeah, that'll be our overarching philosophy, is, you know, trying to get a pulse and a oil seed in that mix.
You'll have it in the mix, but not necessarily all in the same year.
No, that's what we're thinking.
That's an interesting strategy to make your block more attractive to contract on a smaller scale.
When you're smaller, for sure. That's just one of the considerations, because we all know, you know, how important timeliness is in any, whatever you do, whatever, whether it's cropping or livestock. It's like timeliness is second to none, just about. So, which goes into that whole other thing of that owner versus contractor model. And even at work, we've done it to death. And I think lots of other people have done it. And I still don't think there's a perfect answer out there. There's so many other variables. But at this stage, we are looking at it mainly a contractor model.
So a bit of a dry year, this one. How have things gone this year and what are your plans this year?
Probably seen, this is June now, so we've had the driest March. I reckon we have one of the driest Mays we've seen. So in terms of establishing crops, it's been really difficult in this part of the world. So we've had, you know, the biggest flood we've ever had, and on a lot of our cropping country at depth and for a long period of time. So this farm had water laying over parts of it for 3.5 months. So what that's done is deoxygenated the soil, I believe. I don't know if that's ever been quantified, but I think that, and it compacts the soil from being wet for so long and having all that weight of water sitting on top of it. So we've had to go through and cultivate everything. So longer term, as part of the philosophy, we want to be as minimum till as we can. We have sodium issues on this soil on this farm, and in my experience, reduced tillage is and ground covers, like, two of the best cultural practices you can add to lime and gypsum, essentially, to try and remedy siccity. So we really want to go down that track. After the flood, we just had to cultivate, unfortunately. So we had to offset everything and then speed till it, and then we've sown just about everything dry. The history was, the previous people that leased the farm had the whole plant farm in the canola, which is really fortunate for us, because canola is a really good rotational crop. So it gives you a really good opportunity to change your chemistry up for ryegrass control. And as you know, it's a really good disease break for stuff such as crown rot and take all. So from that point of view, really great to be able to just go bang, come in straight with all cereals. So we've been able to, yeah, get the crop in, but we've just received 12 mils of rain overnight, and we're hoping that's going to be enough to establish it. Now, we're lucky in the fact that because that flood went over, we do have a lot of subsoil moisture. So even though we've had a really dry autumn, we're still sitting on a good amount of soil moisture. And we really only need probably 20 or 30 mils this time of year to get the crop up and going and established, and hopefully a little bit of rain in spring to bring it home. So that's been our program this year. But it's, yeah, it's certainly been one of the more challenging autumns that I've seen in the last few years anyway.
Have you got any advice for people that probably don't have their crop in at the moment?
Not really. Like, it's everyone's situation is different, I guess. But, you know, I think anecdotally, I feel like the season's just running a couple of weeks later. Like, it's quite warm for this time of year. Soil temp's still high. For all those sort of reasons, I think there's still an opportunity to get crop in and up if you've had enough rainfall to do so. If you've got subsoil moisture, if you look at things individually, we're going into a dry period, I think. Looks to be an El Nino. And if you look at the cyclic nature of SOI in Australia and its impact on rainfall, like, you know, we've just had three of the wettest. Statistically speaking, we will go into a dry period. Like, it just doesn't stay wet for 10 years. It we generally have a dry period. So going in a dry period is a concern for everybody, no doubt. You know, you look at things individually. If you're sitting on a full profile, then your risk profile is slightly different than maybe this time next year when we're not sitting on a full profile. So, you know, if you're sitting on a full profile, wheat price is okay. I think that I'd still be looking at sowing myself. If you didn't have a full profile, then, yeah, I think you'd probably have to have a good chat to your agronomist and bank manager and see what your risk profile is.
Mate, you just mentioned it before about contractors. Do you have some of your own gear or how are you operating at the moment?
So we have a good share arrangement with a spray rig. So I provide the tractor and a good mate of mine, and also our contractor provides me the spray rig. So I do our own spraying and I do his spraying. So that's the arrangement with that, with just us starting out. And then outside of that, it's pretty much a full contract model for us. Lots of reasons. Like, we're in our first year and, you know, there'll be lots of family farms and farmers out there, I'm sure, can attest to, like, we really find that this is a really important year, the first year. I think it's your foundation year. So for us, it's about maybe not getting in too deep too early. From a financial point of view, we want to, you know, manage our risk as best as we can. So, yeah, we certainly don't, you know, we made the decision that we don't want to have large machinery repayments in our first year. As we go on down the journey, I firmly believe owner-operator model is better, but solely because of timeliness. For me, timing is so important in ag.
It's one of the key things I learned as an agronomist, the difference between the good farmers and the guys that maybe aren't getting the best yields is that they're getting the sprays on time or they're getting their operations done.
Definitely. So when I say I think owner-operator is best, it's only because of timeliness. So if you can get a contractor model where you get timeliness, then like, that's a terrific model, and that's what we really try to do at work, and that's what we're currently doing here. We surround ourselves with some really good contractors, and everything to this date, touch wood, has been on time.
It is interesting that probably the one thing that you've got at this stage is access to a sprayer. Would you say that that's the most important operation for a farmer, for a cropper?
Yeah, I think so. I think spraying is very timely, and often we have very narrow windows, especially, you know, some fungicides on pulses and stuff like that where it's got to go out in front of rain. Timely knockdowns, like I think you would have saw some of the data about, you know, how many millimetres of water a day can be consumed by a weedy fallow. So, yeah, I think timeliness of spraying is really important. Seen some really big swings with sowing dates though as well, like just a couple of days either side of an event, you know, having huge effects on yield. So they're all important at their own time, you know, like a head is pretty important if you've got rain coming too. So, but yeah, I think the sprayer, you probably, like, you think about it, you're on it more often. You know what I mean? You sit on the sowing rig once in a paddock, you sit on the header once in a paddock, you might sit on a spreader once or twice, but you might spray a paddock six or eight times nowadays.
And just more of these dry autumns, mate, and you'll just dry sow all the time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, dry sowing.
Yeah, yeah, very effective.
It's good. It's easy on people and machinery, but as you've probably seen in your past, like, it can be an issue with weeds as well, dry sowing. Like, everything comes up at the same time and puts lots of pressure on pre-emergence and post-emergence, and dry sowing should always be part but maybe not all of the sowing program.
Mate, I've had a cracker today, but just for my last question, I like to ask, what do you think the big issue in Australian ag is at the moment?
There's a couple that come to mind. I think the stock standard answer is labour. I think everyone would agree with that, and not downplaying that at all. But I actually think the bigger issue that I'm seeing probably at the moment is profitability and margin, like what you can actually make per hectare per year comfortably.
And especially with the price.
Yeah, it's being eroded, yeah. I think our parents, you know, it was very different for them as it was for their parents. But I think what we're seeing now, what our kids will see, like, that's what's probably scaring me, is the amount of money that is outlaid to achieve quite a small margin is concerning. Now, I don't have any answers for it, but yeah, that is an issue that's going to that the whole industry is facing. And capital gains is really exciting in ag, and that's why we're seeing lots of foreign investment in Australian ag and corporate investment, because the capital gains there. But for a family farm who don't necessarily realise capital gains and they're solely living off per hectare profit, yeah, that's a concern. So like everyone, I think, has always done, the better farmers where we'll see people succeed is where they're efficient and they are extracting as much profitability per hectare as possible.
You hear the stories about guys in the 60s and 70s and 80s paying farms off in 1 or 2 years. They've ripped off a big 12-bag crop and all of a sudden they're the richest man in the district.
Absolutely. And I think for people that are wanting that, like, to get into the ag industry, like, I don't certainly don't want to turn anyone off because it's an awesome industry. And I think there's definitely money in it, but make sure you're doing it because you like it. You know what I mean? Like, it's probably not going to be that one, that industry that from a farming point of view, like, it might not be the most highest chance of striking it rich. But in terms of a lifestyle, like, we keep saying we're rich because we get to do something we love and, you know, we do it as a family. And that's what makes farming really cool, I reckon. If I was doing it for the money, I'd probably go and go into the bank or something, like work for LLS. So.
Mate, I reckon that's a cracking way to finish up. So thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
No, my pleasure. It's good fun.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Central West Local Land Services. Local Land Services delivers advice and support to farmers, landholders, and the community across New South Wales. To learn more, you can find us online by searching for Central West Local Land Services. If you'd like more information about the topics we discussed today, as well as links to relevant articles, fact sheets, events, and other helpful resources, we've added those into the show notes for this episode. You can find them by tapping or swiping over the cover art in your podcast player now. Hey, and while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review. It really helps other farmers find the show. I'm your host, Neralee Brennan, and I'll chat to you next time.